Everybody, we're going to get going on some Genesis. We're going to do a quick recap of some of the things we've looked at in the last few weeks. And then today we're going to take a look at, if you see the scriptures on the board over here, or take a look at your outline, we're going to look at chapters 9, 10, and 11 as we keep moving through the book. And as before, we're concentrating pretty much on the important spiritual lessons. There's so much detail in the book of Genesis. There's all these stories, which I'm kind of going to assume are mostly familiar to you in terms of the things that actually happen, and then there are a lot of details that might be interesting that I'm pretty much covering in the notes, because in the class we want to take the time to focus more than anything else on the important spiritual lessons that we can get out of studying the book of Genesis. Genesis was written not just to tell us that there's a God, because as Romans said, we really should be able to tell that without someone informing us of that. We ought to be able to look at the world and see that there's a God who created it. Genesis is written to tell us who God is, what kind of a God created this world, that we can understand the things that are important to God, that we can understand the things that matter to God, and that we can understand the motives and the desires behind the things that God has done. And we'll continue with that today, as we've done in the first few weeks. Art's going to lead us in a short time of prayer. You know, I kind of like whenever we have celebrities in class to have them lead the prayer. So, you know, I've asked Art to get us started off today, and then we'll get into some Genesis.
Let's pray. Dear Father, thank you so much for allowing us to be here today. Thank you for blessing us with the day. Even though it's raining outside, help us to always try to have a positive attitude about things, and help us to always look at the good side of things, because you're on our side and you've won the victory over death. Help us as we study the Bible today to draw closer to you, to learn about you, and to have a better relationship with you. And be with Mark as he's sharing his lesson with us today, and help him to speak clearly so we can understand, as he always does. Thanks for blessing us again, and watch over us and protect us. Your son's name, I pray. Amen.
Amen. All right. Thanks very much. Just to start off, a quick recap of what we've looked at in the first 3 weeks of class. In Genesis 1 and 2, we look at the way God created things, and the key spiritual point there is that before sin came into the world, before there was the rebellions and the violence and everything, we were able to see Adam and Eve, the first man and the first woman, living in God's presence, and that's the ideal. When we talk about having a relationship with God, that's really what we mean, or at least what we should mean. And so God created this garden in which they were able to live, garden he had made, and all he asked of them was to take care of the garden, and then there were two trees that they weren't supposed to touch. Well, of course, what happens then is they sin. They make the mistake of listening to the serpent instead of to God. And the first sin that we read about in the Bible is not something violent, it's not something disgusting, it's not something immoral. It's a simple act of disobedience to God, simple act of rejecting what God said because this guy said it was okay. And it's significant that that would be the first sin, as opposed to something that we would obviously think was wrong, because that's really what the root of sin is. It's being willing to accept something that someone else says as equal with the Word of God. And it doesn't matter whether it's something that some person claiming to be a Christian says. It doesn't make any difference if it's something you read on the internet. It doesn't really matter where you get it. Unless it's from God, it's suspect. And that's something we have a great difficulty doing, because many of the things that God says are directly opposed to all of the world's wisdom and perspectives. It should be that way. That shouldn't be a surprise, because God's eternal and God's spiritual, and the world is temporary and physical. So it shouldn't surprise us when there are times when God says one thing and everybody in the world says another thing. And it's a question of faith to be willing to accept what God says, even if everyone else is not willing to accept it. Well, sin and its consequences, here is what we read about in chapters 3 and 4. Now, we tend, from our human point of view, to look at sin as crime and to want to see the punishment for sin instead of the consequences of sin. Well, the first thing that you notice is that the first thing that happens when the sin is committed is that they can no longer live in this garden. They no longer can live in God's direct presence. The ideal has been destroyed. And this is not an arbitrary punishment that God has decided. Okay, you ate that fruit and I said you couldn't. I'm going to have to think of something now. Okay, I'm going to spank you, send to bed without your dinner, and you got to leave the garden now. Okay, I think that'll do it. That wasn't an arbitrary decision on God's part. It was the natural consequence of sin. You have sinned, you can't live in my direct presence anymore, because it's God's nature that he can't live in the presence of sin. And that's the important thing to see about sin. We tend to see sin in terms of what we don't like about it. Something that we've done that we feel guilty about, or more often someone that someone else did that we find disgusting, or that we're aggravated that they seem to have gotten away with it. We look at it in terms of crime and punishment. But God does not look at sin that way. Whenever God sees a sin, his overriding desire is to forgive that sin if it is possible. Now, the whole gospel teaches us that forgiveness is contingent on our accepting forgiveness, on our realizing that that's what we need is forgiveness instead of trying to make up for it. So being forgiven is not something that comes automatically just because God desires it, because there again, that's God's nature. He can't just let the sin go because he is too righteous, he is too pure. So it helps us to think of sin and its consequences instead of this fleshly concept of crime and punishment. One of the things that we do that causes us to completely miss the point of sin is that we try to think in terms of how bad a sin is, how much punishment it deserves, how many years someone should go to jail for doing that, how many spankings you should get for doing that, you know, how many days you should be grounded, silly stuff like that. To God, every sin has one and the same punishment, if you want to call it that, but it's really just a consequence. According to Isaiah, the arm of the Lord is not too short to save, and his ear isn't too dull to hear, but your sins have done something. They've separated you from God. So to God, separation is always what happens. And here again, it's not an arbitrary punishment. It's inherent. It's automatic. Every time you sin, you create separation. Every single time. Separation between yourself and God, separation between yourself and other people. And it's built in this fleshly concept that we have of how much punishment should be given. We never need to do that because it's built into sin. The more outrageous the sin is, the more excruciatingly selfish it is, the more separation it's going to create between you and other people. We don't need to do that. Now, the world's not going to stop doing that. The world's not going to give up their bizarre courts and jails and all the disgusting fleshly ways that they come up with to make themselves feel self-righteous when other people do something wrong. But we can give up that mentality. We can learn to feel regretful towards sin instead of outrage. We can learn to feel grieved by sin instead of angry that someone might get away with it. Because there's no such thing as getting away with sin. Because separation from God is a far worse punishment than tossing someone in jail. Separation from one another is a far worse punishment than sending someone to bed without their dinner. We just don't want to see it that way only because we're listening to the serpents. The world always tells you, oh, it needs to be punished. We need to have justice here. We need to have closure here. We need to see that justice is done. We can't let this thing go. The world tells you that so many times that you believe it, just like the snake. You can eat it. You can eat it. You can eat it. Oh, yeah, we can eat it. Good. And that's where you have to learn to accept what God says instead of what the world keeps persistently telling you, because they're not going to stop. They're going to stop telling you. The devil is not going to stop telling you. When do you think the devil is going to get tired of trying to get you to sin? It's not going to happen. You're always going to have that effort in your mind. You know, the very first sin, when Adam and Eve first sinned, they lost the garden. They lost the chance to live directly in God's presence. Then their children, Cain and Abel, the next major sin that we read about in the Bible, jealousy, rivalry, competition on the part of Cain leads him to kill Abel. What was Cain's punishment for killing Abel? What did God do to punish Cain for killing Abel?
Separation.
Separation, that's it. God didn't send him to jail. God didn't slice off his arm. God didn't beat him. God didn't kill him. In fact, what did God tell Cain he was going to do to him?
Protect him.
He said, okay, you've killed somebody. There are probably going to be these these angry people out there who want to kill you for it, I'll protect you. I'll let them know that they can't do that. That's something that, again, that is so opposed to our concept of crime and punishment, but that's God's concept, because Cain separated himself, well, he separated himself in a rather drastic way from his brother, didn't he? He no longer could have had that relationship. He no longer could have learned from Abel. Instead of learning from Abel, why did God like your sacrifice? Cain just wants to eliminate what he perceives as a rival. Well, he separated himself from his parents, didn't he? He separated himself from God. All kind of separation. That's why Cain said, if you read the passage in Genesis 4, Cain said, my punishment is more than I can bear. But all that punishment was separation. That was more than he could bear, because all of a sudden, when he committed that crime, he knew that no one needed to do anything worse to him. It was awful enough. All the people that he knew, now he's going to be separated from. Well, the line of Seth, of course, comes into play. Seth was the next son that Adam and Eve had, and that's the line that we follow as we go further in Genesis. The line of Seth multiplies, grows, and you have several generations there where it talks about how long they lived and the children they have, and the humans start to fill the earth. And for the first several generations, it just tells you so-and-so lived so many years, and he had this son, and he lived so many years. And all these guys lived for a long time, 800, 900 years. But then what happens to all of them? How do all of their biographies end? And he died. How is your biography going to end? And he died. And she died. And the point that it's trying to make is, with that apparently mundane recital of generation after generation, is that every generation to itself thinks that it's the whole deal. Yeah, this is what the whole world was prepared for, was us. We're going to do the great things. We're going to accomplish the things no one else ever did. But what's the end of the story? They died. They passed away. Someone else took their place. Someone else took over the world. Because that's the nature of this world, and that's the nature of life in this world. Now, things start to get a little interesting when we get up to Enoch several generations in, because Enoch is the first exception to this pattern, isn't he? Because Enoch was a different kind of person, because it talks about how all this sin that had entered the world kept multiplying and spreading just like the humans did. But Enoch, it says, he walked with God. Didn't do something great, didn't do something incredible, wasn't real brilliant or anything like that, but it says he walked with God. And so God, to set an example, he did something to Enoch. He said, he just took him away. He didn't die. Doesn't ever explain exactly what it was. You know, sent over one of those, they have that commercial on all these basketball games that rent a car from the right company and they'll come over and pick you up so you don't have to get a ride to the rental office. Maybe God did that, I don't know. With Elijah, we know what he did. He sent the chariot. The automobile hadn't been invented yet. So we don't know how God took Enoch, but it says in Hebrews, all of a sudden he wasn't there. God just took him on home. And that's to show us what God really values, walking with God. Because what is walking with God? It's living in his presence. It's realizing that he's there, because that's what he's always wanted. That's always been the idea. Now, Enoch's son, Methuselah, is notable for a different reason. Methuselah's in the Book of World Records. It wasn't the Guinness Book of World Records. It was someone else's book of records back there. But what record did Methuselah set? 969 years old. And he could have kept going, except he died the year of the flood. Now, we don't know exactly what happened. Maybe he just was too stupid to come in out of the rain. I don't know. But probably he died because God eliminated everyone who wasn't faithful. God eliminated all but Noah and his family. Noah was his own great-grandson, and apparently that wasn't enough of a motivation for him. Methuselah's son Lamech made an interesting comment when Noah was born. Lamech said, I think this boy is going to comfort us in our time of struggle and in the painful toil, because already by Lamech's day, the world had become burdensome and filled with sin. And so that's what the name Noah means. The name Noah means comfort. It's an old ancient word for comfort. So he named his son Comfort, because he's going to comfort us in this horrible toil that the world has become. And of course, in the lifetime of Noah, God saw that the sin had so taken over the world that there's this phrase that it says, he saw that every inclination of human hearts was to do evil all the time. just had taken him over to such a degree. But Noah, it says, had found favor with God because Noah was a brilliant scientist, and Noah had solved all the technological problems of the day. And Noah had figured out a way to make the economy a lot better without jacking up their taxes. And Noah had memorized the encyclopedia, so he was real brilliant. And so naturally, God wanted Noah to be the one to save everybody. Well, no, what's it say about Noah? He was a righteous man, and he walked with God. And that's what God was looking for. And so we have the famous story of the flood of water that comes upon the earth. And here again, when God sent that flood of water, in chapter 6, it talks about God's emotions. It said he was grieved. That it wasn't that a fit of anger that God said. It said he was grieved. Why? Because once again, he did not have a choice. He could not let these people continue to live, even in his indirect presence, because their sins had done what? It caused such a separation. And in terms of Noah, Noah was told to build this ark, and he had his family, and he had a lot of furry and feathery and scaly companions in there with him, but that was it, just a little family. And the ark saved him from the water, right? From dying physically. So when we read in 1 Peter chapter 3 about Noah, it says Noah was saved by
water.
By water. It doesn't say it was saved by the ark. It doesn't say, oh yeah, God saved Noah from the ark, so he'll save you too from the horrors of the world. That's not what he says. He said Noah was saved by the water. The same waters that destroyed the uncleanness of the world and purged the world, the same waters saved Noah. Why? How? How could the water possibly save him?
Maybe eventually he would have gotten caught up in the corruption of the world if it hadn't been removed.
Saved him spiritually. Didn't save him physically, saved him spiritually. Because that separation was so strong that it could no longer be warded off. Noah could have been dragged down by the other sin, but even if he wasn't, God had been separated from that world so much that God could no longer let his presence be manifest even as much as he wanted to Noah. Noah sought out God. Noah wanted to walk with God. This sin kept building up, separation, separation, separation. And Noah was saved from undeserved separation from God. And this is what the story of the flood tells us. And therefore, when God then remembers Noah in the ark, that's what God was saving. God was protecting. One of the things you read about a lot, if you read some of my old pals like Isaiah and Jeremiah, they talk a lot about this word, the remnant. The remnant of those who are truly seeking God, the people who really want to walk with God. And it's important to realize that the remnant, on one hand, it's not self-selecting. Hey, we want to be the special ones, God. Yeah, we'll be the remnant. It's not a thing of selfish ambition. And it's also not an arbitrary choice on God's part, an angry choice on God's part. Just going to wipe all those guys out and start over here. It's a regretful necessity. And it's very different from what we tend to think about God, because you even think about the ways that we talk about salvation and souls and being saved or being not saved. It's always, well, I don't know, God can do whatever he wants, can he? I mean, he can just make up whatever rules he wants. Absolutely incorrect. Absolutely 100% false. God cannot do whatever he wants. God does not show favoritism. God does not have the ability to tolerate unforgiven sin. He can't let it in his presence. And even the very fact of condemnation is not an act of punishment. It's an act of separation. Okay, I can't be with you forever. You have to be someplace else forever. I can't let you in. God cannot just do whatever he wants. God doesn't have that option. And God doesn't show favoritism either. If there's someone that God really thought was a great guy and he was particularly proud of making the person for whatever reason, God can't say, I'm going to lower the standard just a little bit. So he missed a few extra Sunday mornings. That's okay. That guy teaching class was a nut anyway. I can understand it. That's not the way God works, and it's very important to realize that everything you read in the scriptures about salvation, about eternity, about heaven, about condemnation, None of that is an arbitrary decision. It's not something God can choose the way he wants to do it. He has to be true to his nature. And his nature is pure, his nature is righteous. And it's on this foundation that the gospel rests. And it's on this foundation that the gospel of blood, the gospel of forgiveness, the gospel of the cross, the gospel of the resurrection and the empty tomb all rest on this understanding. And it's because we have so many other influences from the world that keeps hammering home their distorted ideas of justice, their twisted ideas of crime and punishment and right and wrong, that we just look at the things that God says, oh, well, I still think God can do whatever he wants. You know, we just don't want to accept that the forgiveness that God offers is equally necessary for every one of us. You and I need to be forgiven. There's no other way. There's not some standard. We can't come to church often enough. We can't do enough things to wipe out the sin. We've got to accept it by grace and grace alone. The same is true for everyone else. They've got to make that decision to accept it. You can't make that decision for someone. Then no one else can make that decision for you. The church can't just come up with a program for you to follow. Okay, if you just do this, this, and this, we're pretty sure you're safe. If we ever start doing that, we're seriously overstepping our authority and being able to teach the truth. So this is what these early stories in Genesis teach us. Now, when we come in, we're gonna take a look. We're picking up here after the flood has ended, and picking up after Noah has gone through this lengthy process of determining whether it's safe to come out of the ark, which, as we mentioned last time, it's really well worth thinking about what it was like to be in that ark, month after month. You know, we remember the 40 days of rain, but it was months afterwards that they floated around before they came to rest. And then it was weeks and weeks that Noah just had to keep sending out one bird after another. Okay, let's see if you find any place to rest before they finally realized that it was safe. And then, when it's all over, when it's all done, God gives this promise at the end of chapter 8. He says, never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. And this is where we pick up here, because God is going to start establishing what we like to call a covenant with Noah. Now let's just read the first 7 verses here. You looked at me with great expectation, Jenny. I'd hate to disappoint you. You assumed I was going to call on you, even though I wasn't, but I hate to disappoint anyone. Okay. So could you please read verses 1 to 7 for us?
Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you will fall upon all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air, upon every creature that moves along the ground, and upon all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hands. Everything that lives and moves will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. For your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal, and from each man too. I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it.
Thanks very much. Now, you'll notice some things have not changed. There's some things God says here that he said at the very beginning of the Bible. What's he tell him to do that he told him to do earlier? Yeah, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth. That's what he told him at the beginning, right? Well, this is kind of like starting over. They got to start over now for obvious reasons. But this is still what God wants. He still wants them to go out and do that. Here again, we see over and over again the element of graciousness in God. And in a sense, grace might, because grace becomes such a stereotype word for us, it becomes almost too weak of a word to impress upon us what it really means, because here God's had to destroy almost all of humanity and a great part of the natural world too, because of sin, and because it hurt him so much and it grieved him so much. Now, I'm not a parent, but I know a lot of people who are parents. When your kids go out and do something really awful, what normally changes? You normally restrict their privileges, don't you? You normally take away things, don't you? You normally don't give them extra promises. You normally don't give them extra goodies, do you? But what happens here is God's going to give them extra things. He's going to make it even better. For one, we haven't gotten to the promise of the rainbow, but we're going to get there. He promises them, okay, since you were so bad, and since you blew everything and you hurt me so much, I'm never going to punish you again. And here, he says, okay, I'm going to give you this world back again. You did so well with it the first time. I'm going to let you have the family station wagon once more, right after you wrecked it. But not only that, he's going to give them even more control over it, even more domination over it. If you remember back in Genesis 1, when God first created people, he said, you can eat any of the plants, any of the fruits, any of the grains. But he didn't let them eat the animals at the beginning. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't. I mean, they sinned in every other way, so why shouldn't they break that rule too? But what it does here is it sets us up to see here, he's saying, now, okay, you can go ahead and eat the meat if you want to, too. Instead of taking away privileges, he gives them something new. Okay, I'm going to give you even more than you had before. And it's, again, it's just a part of God's nature that he wants to have us live in his presence. He wants to take away the barriers. He does everything we can. If we don't have the closeness with God that we want, there again, what did Isaiah say the problem is? It's not God's rules. It's not God's attitude. It's our sin. Any time that you sense that you don't have that closeness with God, it's always where the problem is going to be. It's not going to be because, oh, the church just makes up all the... No, it doesn't even mean the church makes up their silly things and doctrines and stuff like that. It has nothing to do with that. Oh, wow, we just live in such a sinful society. No, it has nothing to do with that. Your sin has separated you from God. And if you focus on the right thing and pray about the right thing and study about the right thing, then you can always find God's grace because he always wants to give it to you. That's always been what he wants. And another thing to notice then is grace. One of the reasons why we're so afraid of grace, almost any discussion you get into, oh well, but if you just preach grace all the time, what's going to happen? Chaos, rebellion, abuses. Everyone's going to abuse it. Everyone's going to do that. Well, you know what? You know why people say that? Because they're right. Because people do abuse grace. People abuse anything. People abuse anything that we can create. Is that a reason not to create it? Is that a reason not to do it? Is it a reason not to teach it? Well, no. People can abuse automobiles. Does that mean we should just get rid of them all? People can abuse baseball bats. Does that mean we shouldn't play baseball anymore? Well, no, of course not. People can abuse grace. That doesn't mean we shouldn't strive to understand it. Because to God, grace and privilege and blessing are always accompanied by something we have seen from the very beginning. The very beginning of the Bible, when God put Adam and Eve in the garden, remember what he told them? What did he ask them to do?
Take care of it.
We have a word for that we all dislike. It's a long word that starts with an R and ends with Y.
Responsibility.
To God, these things are always balanced by responsibility. Now see, here again, this is something alien to the world's concept of things. The world views it that if you're real smart and real talented, you should have extra privileges. You should have extra money. You should live in the nice house. You should be able to boss people around. You should have a lot of people waiting on you. The place where I work is filled with these prima donnas who think they're so brilliant and wonderful that they don't want to do anything that they view as beneath them. They just want to have everyone else scurrying around and taking care of them all the time. And the world's filled with people like that. The world's filled with people who think that if they invent something good, they should be on Easy Street the rest of their life. If they do something that amuses people or entertains people, they should have millions of dollars coming in the rest of their life. If they can throw a ball through a hoop or hit a ball farther than someone else can, they deserve to be idolized. They deserve to have privilege and money. God always views it exactly the other way around. Luke 12, verse 48, to those who have been given much, much will be expected. To those who have been entrusted with much, much will be demanded. The more privilege, the more blessing, the more grace you have, the more responsibility you have. There again, that's exactly the contrary of the way the world works it. The world works and fights and competes with each other to get the few available positions of power and distinction, and then they view it as, hey, I got this, now I get to use it.
Now I get to have my way. I got to shove people around. I get to have lots of money. I get to have people waiting on me. God says, no, it's the other way around. And this is seen right here because when God gives them the animals to eat, what's he say immediately afterwards?
Lifeblood in it.
That's right. There's a prohibition. Don't eat the lifeblood because that is, you're going to be held accountable for that. You're going to be held accountable for taking the life. Blood in the Bible is a symbol of life. The lifeblood, the blood flowing through your veins, the very sacrifice of Jesus, spilling his blood is equivalent to letting his life drain out for us, being poured out for us. Well, what God's saying is, okay, they belong to you now, but you're going to be accountable for how you use them. You go around killing them just to amuse yourself or to prove what a man you are, you're going to be held accountable for that. If you got a good reason, if you're going to eat it, if you're going to use the skin to clothe yourself and protect you from the elements, I can accept that. But you're going to be accountable for how you use it. We're accountable for everything that God's given us. And that's true of both the physical world and of our spiritual understanding and awareness. We're responsible for it. We have a responsibility to take care of it, to entrust it, as Paul told to Timothy, entrust it to others, pass it along. And it's this balance of grace and privilege and blessing with responsibility, that's what's missing when people talk about grace. That's why people lurch back and forth between, oh, I'm saved by grace, I can just do anything I want, yippee! And grace leads to license and rebellion and anarchy and chaos, so we're going to have rule, 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 and that way we won't have these problems. That's why people lurch back and forth, because to God, it's always been a nice little balance. It's always been a perfect balance. There's never been a problem. Because you understand the more you've given, okay, now I need to accept responsibility for this. It's a simple enough attitude. Again, if you just stop listening to all the yelling out there and stop looking at all those bad examples of people who think because they're powerful or brilliant that they somehow get all these privileges, if you just read what God writes, okay, everything I give you, you got to respond. I gave you a garden, take care of it. I gave you the animals, you can eat them if you want, but I'm going to hold you accountable for the lifeblood. You're going to be here with a lot of other people, and you're going to be accountable for their lifeblood too. You better not hurt someone else, because I'm going to hold you accountable for that too. And it's a very helpful concept in understanding what God is about and his relationship with us on this perishable earth. He also goes on then, if we go back to the text here in Genesis 9, we're going to pick up with the promise part. Of this covenant, because that's what he's doing. It describes it as a covenant that he's making with Noah. And here's the first part. Okay, I'm gonna give you this stuff. I'm gonna give you extra privileges because you were so good. I'm gonna give you extra privileges, but you're gonna be responsible for them. And then I'm gonna give you a promise. Pick up here if you get someone else to read from 8 to 17. Go ahead, Bev. 8 to 17, if you would.
Okay. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, I now establish my covenant with you. With your descendants after you, and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals, and all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth, I establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is a sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. So God said to Noah, this is a sign of the covenant I have established between me and all life on the earth.
Okay, thanks very much. Now here again we see God's obvious graciousness, his compassion, and we see that, so what God really wants to do, he just to make sure you... Does God think that they're going to get it right this time? Does God think that now Noah and his good little sons and their little wives are just all going to be good little boys and girls from now on? We'll never have this problem again. Now, God's not that silly. God understands what we're like. He made us. He wrote the owner's manual. He knows that the problem section is about 100 times as long as the how to use it section. He understands these things. What he's saying is, guys, I really, really want you to live in my presence. Would you give it a shot? At least if you get a little spare time, would you give it a try? And just to show you how much I want, okay, here's the rainbow. I promise, no more big floods to destroy everything. Nothing else is ever going to destroy it all at once, this big catastrophe like this again. Because I really want you to try to get it right. I'm going to give you every opportunity to get it right. And again, it's something very important to understand about God. And there's a number of interesting things. First of all, he says back up in verse 10, he's making this covenant with whom? Well, certainly with Noah, with his descendants, which includes, well, pretty much everybody. Everyone else was wiped out, so only if you're alive, you're descended from him. And it's interesting, end of verse 10, every living creature. In other words, he's not just making a covenant with Noah and not even with his descendants, but he says with every living creature. Because God, again, we're the part of his creation that was made in his image. We're the part that everything else was made for. But God said the rest of it was pretty good too. It was pretty good. And he entrusted to a bunch of lunkheads like us. You know, letting a teenage kid that just got his license drive your BMW out there on the freeway and just see what happens. God still likes what he made. He loves us, but he likes what the rest of the stuff he made too. And he says, I'm promising the rest of him, okay, all the birds and the animals and everything like that, you know, it's going to be rough living with these humans. They're going to goof up a lot, but I'm not going to destroy you all at once. Promise that won't happen again. It's just an interesting aspect of God. And he says that never again then is he going to do this. And, you know, the New Testament tells us that when the day of the Lord comes, it's going to come how? Like a thief. Just okay, wake up, trumpet call, it's over, that's it. There's not going to be this brutal flood, months and months of agony and stuff like that. It's just all of a sudden God's going to say, okay, the time has come. For whatever reason is good and sufficient to him, he says, I'm not going to do it that way again. I'm not going to send the flood waters and destroy everything and have to start over again. And we have some scientific minds in here, right? A rainbow, scientifically, how does it occur?
Water
vapor or mist or rain droplets in the air that is being illuminated by the sun, which you're seeing the refraction of the sun off of these water droplets in the air. So two things are needed for a rainbow. There has to have just been
rain.
A lot of rain, and now there has to be sun. So it's a very simple symbol that even if you don't understand the scientific explanation for it, you can still get that part, right? There was rain, now there's sun. So what's God saying? Every time it rains, it's going to stop. Whatever bad out there, it's going to stop. I'm not going to say exactly when. I'm not going to say limit from now on, you know, 2 hours max or anything like that. But everything bad is going to stop. Whatever it is, it's going to stop at some point. When I decide to bring everything to an end, I'm just going to send my son down. He's going to come like a thief, and that's going to be it. So the stuff that you're going through now, we always have that promise. It's going to stop. It's going to end. Be something else come along sooner or later. But what God is saying is don't get yourself so fixated on the problems of the here and now. And I'm going to give you that rainbow as a visible sign. And it's interesting, it's a sign that not only is visible, rainbows are kind of aesthetically pleasing. You know, it's not so, God could have put a skull and crossbones up in the sky. Okay, well, after it rains, I'll put a skull and crossbones up there just so that you know that if I'd wanted to, I could have let it get going. But I decided not to because I'm a nice guy. It's something pretty to look at, and it reminds us of something nice. So it's very simple symbolism, but it's so well worth thinking about. Now, this next passage here, if I get a volunteer to read chapter 10, I know you've all been competing to want to be the one to read this. I'm joking, I hope, if you know what Genesis 10 is, it's all these hideous names. There's this little incident at the end of chapter 9 that's one of these things that is given in the Bible, like watching Abraham lie about Sarah being his sister, or watching Moses become super wimp when God told him to talk to Pharaoh, or watching David commit his various sins. It's in there to show us that Noah, as great a guy as he was, he had his problems. There's this little family squabble. I'm running short on time, so I'm just going to have to recommend that you read the notes if you wanted to understand a little better. It's kind of passages a lot of people get off track on and think it means something and it doesn't. Chapter 10, I'm not going to make you read. If you want to give yourselves a few hours of tedium, you can read through it and learn how to pronounce all the names. I won't force you to do that. It's what's traditionally been called the Table of Nations. It's been called the Table of Nations for hundreds of years because it kind of gives you a little sketch of Noah's sons, three sons he had, Japheth and Ham and Shem. Kind of gives you a little sketch of how from those three sons people spread across the earth. Japheth is the one in the Bible we know the least about. The people who study it tend to think that he was probably the ancestor of the European peoples, the future European nations, and some of the larger Asian nations. That's mostly because they don't think it could have been the other two. Doesn't make that much difference, but it's just to give you an idea, that's kind of where it's going. Ham is the son that, in the ancient world, his descendants were the most numerous and the most powerful. Ham was the ancestor of the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, all the great societies of the what we would call the Old Testament times. Ham was also the ancestor of the Canaanites, with whom the Israelites would come in conflict later. Shem's line was the least powerful, the least popular physically, but it's from Shem that has descended ultimately the nation of Israel. And you can take a look in toward the end of chapter 10 when it talks about Shem. Down in verse 24 and verse 25, it mentions this guy Eber, several generations out. Eber is the guy from which we get one of the names that we associate with Israel. What's it look like?
Hebrew?
Yeah, Hebrew. Eber is the guy that the Eberus or the Hebrews, that's one of the names that became attached to the Israelites later, but that's several generations in the future. Just to give you a little sketch, and again, I wrote some things in the notes for those of you who like those technical kind of things. But here in verse chapter 11, we run across another incident. We've got to really have several centuries take place between Noah's sons and the next person that the Bible really focuses on, because eventually this line of Shem gets to Abram, whom we'll meet next week. That's actually several hundred years of a gap in there. There's really only one thing that happens in those hundred years that Genesis tells us about, and that's this incident in the first part of chapter 11, this building this tower, the Tower of Babel. And if you look here, it says that the whole world had one language and a common speech. Well, that wouldn't be too difficult when there was only eight of you. That wouldn't be too hard to have a few things in common. Well, of course, they do multiply and begin to fill the earth again, as God had asked them to do. And as men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, that's an ancient name for Babylon, and settled there. And they said to each other, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. They said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth." Well, at least you got to give them credit. At least they're not going to make the same old mistakes over again. They're going to go ahead and make some new mistakes instead. You know, have a little bit of variety in there, so at least that's something new. Well, they get this idea in their head, let's build a tower. Let's see if we can build a tower. Now, why did they want to do this?
Make a name for themselves. Show off.
Make a name for themselves. And it's kind of interesting the way it says it. We're going to make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. So they're looking for, they want to have significance of a fleshly kind. They want to have a fleshly kind of security. They want to have a fleshly sense of being important, being powerful. Prove that they can do it. We're going to prove that we can do it. Well, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. The Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they'll not understand each other. Well, what is God's concern? It's kind of interesting. People sometimes misinterpret what it says here. If I let them do this, nothing will be impossible, as if somehow they're going to overthrow God or something. I think you know that's not what it means. What is God concerned about, Jim?
I think he's concerned that they're going to just start bullying around all the other human beings.
Because when you focus on, I'm going to prove that I can do something, that's what happens. Once you start to compete, I prove that I can do it, I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it, I can do this, I can do that. Isn't that where all the world's problems come from? All these hideous wars that we have, it's because I want to prove that I can force you to do what I think you ought to do. Isn't that where all these fights and squabbles that you have with politics and differences between cultures and races and religions, isn't that where they all come from?
We're still spending billions of dollars to build the highest building.
You know, it's really true in a literal way too. I can build it. I can build a taller building. I can make a faster car. I can build a more powerful computer. And you see, it's one of those things that human nature never really changes. You know, when I was in high school, which is back in the 70s, I can remember standing around with the guys, and I won't tell you where we were standing around or what else we were doing. I was a pagan then. But I remember one of the things that would always come up is all the boys in my high school would always debate their cars. Whose car? I got a 350cc engine. Oh, I got a 455 in mine. Well, mine'll go from 0 to 60 in 5 seconds. They'd always debate that stuff. Now, guys, I don't think they do that anymore. What do guys do now when they get together and want to show off who's the most masculine? My computer has 10 gigs on it. What about yours? Yeah, well, I got version 10.6. You only got 10.4. It's the same silly thing. The same silly thing. And that's silly, but it's also kind of more serious, too. There's some things we ought to appreciate about human society because, see, look in the Bible. They might make different mistakes, but here's these people long, long ago doing the same stuff that we do. Here, back in Genesis chapter 6, God said every inclination of their heart was just evil all the time. Well, that could describe what's going on today, too. We so often fall into the thinking that there's been times in the glorious past when everyone was good and everyone loved God and believed God and went to church all the time and they just weren't as sinful as they are now. Well, we make those decisions based on outward things because the sins that particularly bug us go in and out of fashion. And the other sins that don't bug us go in and out of fashion too. So we look back at the times when the fashionable sins were the ones that don't bug us and we make up in our minds this false scenario of how wonderful it was back then. A lot of people will look back at the 1950s and say, oh, it was so good back then. We didn't have homosexuals. We didn't have abortions. Those things were illegal and everyone was good. Well, you know what? That's true. Back in the 1950s, if you wanted to be a popular or powerful person, you could not come up and say, I think it should be okay for people to have abortions and for homosexuals to marry. You couldn't do that. There were plenty of abortions in the 1950s, just as many as there are now. There were plenty of homosexuals in the 1950s, just as many as there are now. Now, in a narrow arithmetical sense, there was probably less sin in the 1950s because there were less people running around. So if you just counted up all the sins, there'd probably be fewer of them. But the degree to which sin had captured human hearts was just as fine. See, in the 1950s, it was perfectly acceptable for a public figure to stand up and say that they think that other races were inferior to theirs. It was perfectly acceptable for public figures to stand up and talk about how women were not as intelligent as men are. It was perfectly acceptable to do those things. You can't do them now. They're out of fashion. Different sins are in fashion. Which of those sins is worse to God? Which worse to God, racism or abortion? Both. Both. Let Deion Sanders answer that for you. They're both hideous. They're both disgusting. They both cause separation. They're both loathsome. It's just that you're not bothered by some of them and you're bothered by other ones. Human nature has always been controlled by sin. There's no such thing as this mythical past when everything was wonderful and people were less sinful. It just doesn't work that way. And that's one side of it. And the other side of it is take a look at this thing and realize this problem here is they're concerned, they want to prove what we can do. They're trying to prove what we can do. We can build a tower. We can do it. What should they have been thinking about? Well, this is one of your lines from Jurassic Park, John. They're so concerned with what they can do that they're not thinking about what they should do. Now, see, as Christians, we're very susceptible to that, too. Because we want to say, we want to be a great church. We can do it. We can do it. Yeah, yeah, rah, rah, team. Pep talk, program, program. How do you know that's what God wants from you? How do you know that's what God wants from us? How do you know that's the way he wants to use us as an example? How do you know he doesn't want to use us as the example of the church that can go through every form of hideous suffering and still be faithful? How do you know that God wants us to be the church with 10,000 members? The answer is you don't know that. You have no idea. James chapter 4, take a look at it sometime. Now listen, you who say today or tomorrow, we're going to do this and that and the other, we're going to accomplish this. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You don't know that. Your job is to remain faithful. What you should do is to remain faithful. And even if you put this pseudo-spiritual spin on it, it doesn't make it better. Now, once again, I'm not sure how many weeks in a row I'm going to keep putting a goofy quote on the board over here, but I'm doing it one more week. There's an old Edgar Allan Poe story called Never Bet the Devil Your Head. Now, this is one of those things, I should put an advisor on it, because Phil Staffa believes that the reason why today I'm emotionally unstable is because when I was a kid, I read all these Edgar Allan Poe stories, and I used to watch The Twilight Zone all the time. I'm trusting that your mind has now been formed. You're no longer in your formative years, so you can handle Edgar Allan Poe without being permanently ruined like Phil thinks that I was. But it's this old story. It's actually a little bit lighter than most Edgar Allan Poe stories, but it does have its gruesome features, which I guess is... There again, do I like Edgar Allan Poe because I was already emotionally disturbed, or did I become emotionally disturbed by reading all these gruesome stories? But it's about these two friends, two lifelong friends, and the one guy's always boasting about things. He's always, oh, I can do this, I can do that. And when his other friend says, well, I don't know, that's pretty tough, he's always saying, oh, I'll bet you anything. I'll bet you all my life savings. I'll bet you my house. I'll bet you anything you care to name. And the guy gets so boastful all the time that every once in a while he'll say, oh, I'll bet the devil my head I could do that. And the two guys, one day they're walking, Edgar Allan Poe lived in the 1800s, so there's no motor vehicles or anything. They're walking down a road to go visit somebody, and they come to one of these old covered bridges that they used to have, you know, to get across rivers and stuff like that. It was just for walking, not for vehicles. And they had those old covered bridges, they had these little turnstiles so that animals wouldn't wander onto the bridge. So that a person would just push the turnstile and then move through. And they're coming up to it, and they're coming up to the bridge, and the one guy says, oh, you'll have to watch this, it's kind of stuck, you know, so they haven't oiled it in a while or something. And this boastful guy says, oh, I don't need to push it, I'm just going to jump over it. And the guy says, well, you know, look, it's a covered bridge, you know, there's these steel beams up there, you're going to hit your head or something, so don't, just, come on, we can push it across. Oh, I can do it, it's no problem, come on, it's a piece of cake. The guy says, come on, I'll just push it, I'll do it for you. He says, oh, that's so easy, I could jump over the thing and click my heels as I go over it. He says, come on, you don't have to prove that. You know, I know you could do it, but don't take any chances. I worry about this bridge, it's got all that steel and everything up there. He says, I'll bet the devil my head I could do it. And the next thing I know, this is an Edgar Allan Poe story. Mm-hmm. Next thing I know, there's this distinguished looking guy standing there. Sticks his hand out, grabs this boastful guy's hand, gives it a shake, and says, good luck. And the guy gets off to a running start and goes, jumps up in the air and clicks his heels and comes down with a big plop. And his friend notices there's this little round object sailing through the air that this other little distinguished guy grabs and trots away with it. Because he hit his neck square on one of those little beams up there. You see, the point is, if you bet the devil your head, can you possibly win? If you win, you get to keep your head. Well, you already had it. If you lose, you lose big. That's what it's like when we go around trying to prove that I can do it. We can do this. We can be great. We can be wonderful. We can prove this. That's what it's like. You're betting the devil your head. You can't possibly win anything because, as Jesus said, if you're going to do something, do it in secret. If you're going to pray in your closet where nobody can see it. If you're going to fast, make sure nobody knows, because otherwise you just got your reward. People knowing you could do it. The trivial, worthless little reward. If you really want to do what God wants, think about what you should do. Think about what God's called you to do. We know what God's called us to do. Be faithful. Love your neighbor. Don't worship the same idols as the world. We just don't like those because anybody can do that. There's no distinction in it. There's no pride. There's no feeling of superiority. But that's what God's called us to do. Think of what you should do, and don't bet the devil your head. I got to let you go. We'll pick up next week. We'll meet Abram next week. We'll learn some new things, I hope, about the lessons of the book of Genesis.